So our agenda for today, intro to web service protocols, SOAP, XML, WSDL, HTTP, an overview of our copious web service protocol documents, 2010 SP1 improvements, some of the things that we've added, and the bulk of the presentation is actually a collection of tips, tricks, and best practices that we compiled through questions that are asked on forums, CSS questions we get asked, internal questions. There's a lot of common themes that we see in common areas that people are asking questions in. And then we'll end with a Q&A. So the protocols we use SOAP, XML, WSDL, and HTTP, and the rationale behind choosing those was their standards-based open protocols. They're widely supported, and it does have cross-platform interoperability. So, overview of the docs. I'll let Michael cover this piece.
Okay, so
hold on here.
So we segmented the web service protocol documentation around functional areas. We tried to mirror the functional areas that are represented by the RPC ROP documentation. So like earlier today, you saw a presentation about bulk transfer, fast transfer. There's also a web service doc around fast transfer, and that pattern actually exists throughout all of our documentation. So you do have options in terms of features. If you are creating clients, so you should also consider the web service options as well. The SOAP protocol specifications generally have a naming convention that starts with MS.-OXWS. Some of the earlier documents do not have that same naming specification. It's actually some of these documents includes the unified messaging, configuration, out of office, mail tips, and availability service have a slightly different naming convention for the short name, which is MS-OXW. So in general, we broke up the SOAP protocol docs into four kind of categories of docs: store-based, feature-based, kind of a common data, you know, often used by many of the different protocol web service protocols based docs, and also a hybrid. So our store-based protocol web service protocol docs are they map to lots of the different item types within the Exchange store, such as contacts, tasks, calendar items, messaging, email messages. So those are generally mirror what you would find in the Exchange store database. Our feature-based protocol docs usually work around synchronization, notifications, basically the type of features that do not have any specific type of store items that they work against, but are available for working with all different types of Exchange store data. We put all the common data types into two documents, MSOXWSC data, which is our common data type document, and OXWS XProp, which is we use for extended property for access to store data, such as that aren't actually first-class properties as defined in our web service schema. And the last type of web service protocol doc we have is kind of a hybrid of the two between a store-based and a feature-based. So those are going to include generic operations for accessing items in the store, the basic CRUD type operations, create, retrieve, update, delete, and also defines a basic item types for the store items. So the SOAP web service protocol documents, they all include at least one WSDL message schema file and a type schema file. We have a naming convention that is based on the document short name. So, for example, MS-OXWS-CData would have a WSDL file with that short name descriptor, .WSDL. Same thing with messages, it would be that doc short name descriptor dash messages.xsd, and same pattern for types as well. The source schema file and WSDL files that we used for segmenting are that we segmented to form our web service protocol documents. It was rather quite large and very complex with a lot of relationships between the and dependencies between the different types in that source schema. So we had to break out the types and operations that define the web service into mini documents. So what ends up happening is there's a very complex web of relationships between your WSDL messages and XSD schema files that will require you to have a valid set of schema files. You will need to make sure they are all maintained in a single directory. There's a many include and import statements that are required to have a valid set across all of those docs. So we'll actually, later on in this presentation, we will cover a couple, actually an important tip that you'll want to consider when working with these documents.
So the next thing I wanted to cover was the functionality enhancements and kind of how we've evolved through the different versions. So 2007 was the first version of Exchange that offered web services, and it was a start to getting access to those store items so you could build your own client, offer some of this information in a portal, or have a service that looked at some of that information and returned it to either a portal or a client. You had full access to items, folders, and attachments. You could do the big operations on them. Availability, OOF settings, notifications, which is a piece we'll talk about in the tips and tricks. Synchronization, name resolution, and search. And SP1 added delegate management, so you can delegate somebody to have access to your mailbox on their behalf. Folder permissions, public folders, and ID conversion. 2010 really added quite a bit more to the web services. User config information, SOAP auto discover, that's another piece that we'll get to in the tips and tricks. It had previously just been XML based. Time zone support, looking up room resources, dumpster access, that's the information that's been removed that you may want to get access to again if you want to restore it. And 2010 SP1, we have some tips and tricks in this section as well, but we added inbox rule support, archive mailbox support, conversations. So in the Outlook client, there's this notion of conversations and grouping these by subject, so you don't have to go looking through your whole stack of email and your client in order to figure out who said what. Some people loved it, some people didn't. Streaming notifications. The streaming notifications, we'll go over a little bit more in the tips and tricks, but that essentially keeps an open channel to the server so that you can listen for events. So, tips and tricks. Like I said, this is really a list that we compiled through CSS folks, forums, questions that we get to our web service alias. Client proxy generators. So there's some pros and cons to these, and we've seen some incidents related to this, and in the con part, depending on the tool that you use to generate a client proxy, the results can be different and sometimes even a little bit confusing. The pros, it does make it easier for you to develop a client. It abstracts away you having to craft these individual SOAP messages to communicate with the web service on the server side. On the cons again, it's indeterminate how they implement the WSDL SOAP and XML. And as some examples, there's several different tools you can use to generate these proxy generators. Some that we had were WSDL.exe, SVCUtil.exe, SProxy.exe, some open source ones, Apache Axis, Axis 2. They'll all do it a little bit differently and give you different results.
I'd like to make a point that the WSDL files do not have a service element, and so many proxy generators have an issue with that, and they will not create the proxy object model because of that. So if you are going to use a proxy generator, you might have to add a service element. The reason why the service element is not there in the WSDL file is because the server and clients are expected to use the auto-discover feature to actually identify the endpoint used for client access.
So that was a good segue into the auto-discover piece. We offer two flavors of this, the SOAP-based, which was added not that long ago, and the POX, plain old XML version of it. We do support both. And the benefit to auto-discover, one of the benefits that Michael just alluded to was we can discover those endpoints. You don't have to, if you're building a client, you don't have to hard code those endpoints to your server. You can discover them and use those in your client. The servers will, they share that information and get that back in the response when you request it. And when you do create a binding to a service on the server side, cache that. Don't try to open one all the time, constantly opening services. That can cause some perf issues. And if you, one thing that Outlook does and other clients that are implemented, if you are having a connectivity problem, re-kick auto-discover. If there's a failover situation, if you have servers failing over to different data centers or some particular server has failed, the endpoint may have disappeared initially for that client. If you re-auto-discover, you can reconnect to your mailbox.
So the auto-discover is the username? You can repeat the question.
Say that again?
The input to the auto-discover is the username?
So the question is, the input to auto-discover is the username. Yes, that can be one of the inputs, and there's credentials passed as well. And the username can be the form, user@domain.com. So searching. There's different flavors of searching. Some have more of an impact on the server than others. The simple searching, it allows you to limit what's returned in a particular request, and it's really ideal for retrieving only what you're interested in. It does use restrictions, and restrictions are similar to using a where clause in SQL. That causes some expensive operations server side. This is the option you should use if the query is changing all the time. Advanced searching. Paging can allow you to return only a subset of the record, so you don't have to try and get everything all at once. You can just get what you need. If it's not there, go to the next page. Search folders. A search folder is really like a search that's always turned on. It's a folder that has a condition set on it to only have information that's relevant to that condition. Those are a folder with restrictions, and they're more appropriate for using with frequent or unchanging queries. We added client-side filtering on here. You can do client-side filtering. It's very beneficial to use to allow the server to do the work for you, but there are times that if you're using a, if you're really returning a large data set and you want to do some parsing of that data set, it may be beneficial to do some of that on the client. Notifications. So as I mentioned a little bit earlier, there are a few different types of notifications that we have. The push model, that's where the notifications are sent by the server notification subsystem to the client. Pull, the client is asking for information from the server. And streaming, this is where the connection is always on. When you subscribe to a streaming notification, the client will immediately be notified of a change server side. And the two different environments to think about when you're looking at notifications, tightly coupled environment, that's where the client is really on a, think of a corporate network. You're on a fast network, the servers aren't, may not be that far away, and it's IP addressable. A loosely coupled environment is a wide geographic network. It could be over a slow link, and the client is probably not IP addressable from the server and not always reliably connected. There's some places that have servers with, you know, maybe as low as modem connectivity, and they only get free synchronization updates.
So the question was, are these what? Which type of notification is most appropriate for either a tightly coupled or a loosely coupled environment?
So for a tightly coupled environment, streaming is definitely an appropriate one. That's going to have the connection open all the time. For a network that's not reliably connected, that's probably not a great option. The push and the pull might be better for the loosely coupled environments. I don't know if Michael has additional comments.
Yeah, in fact, the streaming notification model is taking the place of the push notification model. Much like you saw in the presentation earlier tonight about notifications, the push model is no longer available for the RPC or the ROP access. So yeah, moving forward for 2010 onward, forget about push and just use the streaming model.
Inbox rules. This was added to Service Pack 1, and allows you to create through your client some server-side rules for the user's inbox, whatever conditions they want to set, filter out messages, delete messages, etc. There's a whole bunch of conditions that we offer through Outlook that will be stored server-side. Attachments. This is one that we have a lot of questions on the forums for folks that are developing clients. If we look back at the earlier slide we had about proxy generators, the proxy generators, it can take a lot of code to deal with attachments. You have to do several steps. You have to first look for them. Depending on how you look for it, it could be expensive or not expensive based on the types of searching that you're using. Then you have to bind to that message, and then you can interact with the attachment. Accessing archive information. This is another one that we added to SP1, and it's available via a couple of different protocols, and the relevant docs are MS, OXWS, SRCH, OS Search, and MX, OXWS Core. And there are some, I think there are some others that are associated with it too. And it allows you to search for archive items based on certain criteria, and this, if you're building a client to access archive information, that archive information could live in another data center, it could live locally in your data center, It really doesn't matter where it is. It'll look just like it's living in the client. It should be transparent to whoever's using that client. Availability. This is where you can check the system for users, rooms, and resources in certain time windows. And one piece that is important is to have a mechanism to share between services.
Second point. So you might have multiple mini exchange servers servicing accounts that are different mailboxes on different servers. So in order to make the availability service work as you might experience in your test environments, the servers should share that information and have some kind of mechanism that will provide it so that availability queries that are asking for information about mailboxes on separate servers can be provided to the client.
XML validation. There was a few tips that Michael had that were pretty relevant, and sometimes we get questions about these pieces. The request for the XML should always be validated before processing to make sure that the payload conforms to what the server expects, so you don't have unexpected failures. The server shouldn't validate XML before leaving the server, since it's assumed that if you took the request, that whatever the response is going to be okay. And properly testing all the response XML is a very important piece. We spend a lot of time in our test environments testing these pieces. Validating the response XML would add an extra level of processing that really should be unnecessary if you are testing thoroughly.
You want to add that one? Do you want to cover this one?
Oh, yeah. So there's about, I would say, about 20 web service protocol documents. Each one of them has a most of them have a WSDL and two schema files. As I said earlier, in order to have a validating set, you have to gather all those files together and put them into a directory in order for any type of validation to occur. What we suggest you do to save yourself a lot of headaches is, if you have an Exchange server in your environment, is grab the service, the WSDL and schema files off that server to validate any type of development work you're doing when developing your XML messages. And also, that would be also useful too when doing your proxy generation, if you do choose to use a proxy generator. In the back.
I will clarify for those on the recording. That item is not actually true, in that the best way to obtain services, messages, and types, if you're in fact validating your application against an actual Exchange server, is to go to the endpoint and download those which will be appropriate for that version of the server, right? On the other hand, that is doubly not true, in that services, WSDL, messages, and types.xsd are not licensed as redistributable files, right? So we all know about redistributable APIs. You package the library with your app and ship it. Those are not those. Please don't do that.
So what's the way to do the validation?
Well, the chopped up WSDLs work the same as those WSDLs. So if you want to stay totally clean, you need to use the ones from the protocol specs. If, in fact, you're validating against an Exchange server, then you would obtain the ones from that server by going to that endpoint and downloading them.
So can we have a zip file or an installer for this, please?
Sure, let me pass the mic.
I'll follow up with you after this presentation. How about that? Yeah, thank you, Tom. Thank you for clarifying that. I obviously had some conflicting information. But absolutely, we can definitely look into getting that information put together.
Can we put it in the zip file with the rest of the redistributable documentation, just as the raw rather copy
there? Yeah, we'll look into that for sure. Duly noted.
Versioning. Consider the version of the server in the client request. Somewhat related to what Tom mentioned is depending on the version that you're working against, there may be a different response or behavior depending on what your client is asking for. That version is accessible from AutoDiscover, so you can discover that and determine what you want to, what version you want to go make the request against. One example that that I wanted to throw out there that was a change, which versions? To I think it was moving to SP1. There was an ID format change.
2007 to SP1.
That's it. Bulk transfer. I think this has been covered in some of the RPC presentations. Mm-hmm. We do offer this via the web services as well, and this was recently added in 2010 SB1. And you can export and upload streamed item data. It was really around the scenario for folks that want to implement backup. Is there a question?
Are you going to document the limit on the upload items that was mentioned in the tab?
So are you talking about the maximum default size of the data stream?
The WCF limitation?
Yeah. Well, that's...
I'm not sure, Tom, about that.
Yeah, I think...
There's some specifics to WCF where... There is a limitation of the size of the item that you can put into the store.
I mean, it's a configuration setting, so it can be changed. Yeah.
Yeah. So by default for 2010 SP1, the web config file has a 35 meg limit. That is a configurable limit. Out of the box, it is 35, and that was increased. I think it was 10 or 15 in 2010. That actually went up in SP1. But it is a limit. It's a real limit that you indeed could hit, depending on the size of the items you're trying to get out or put into the store.
Yeah, that I don't know, and I'll definitely get back to you on that one. Approach me afterwards, for sure.
So the question was, I'll repeat that: is does it affect both upload and export? And we'll check. I think it does, but we'll verify that for you. Mm-hmm. Synchronization. So this provides a way to keep a local store synchronized with the server store. An example is, you know, offline mode. If you want to have information sitting on the client in case there's your network's down or connectivity is poor. This is used by the Mac Outlook client. Conversations. This is one of the pieces that I had mentioned earlier was added to 2010 SP1. Earlier versions obviously don't have it. You can group the messages by a conversation in the client, and it can be easier to follow than trying to figure out what people had said before you, and the messages are related by subjects, and you can take actions on those conversations. You can copy them to another folder, delete the entire conversation. That would delete every message associated with it instead of you having to go search for every single message. And you can also move them around. So that was it for tips and tricks. The one thing that I wanted to ask at the beginning that I failed to ask was, how many folks are actually using web services today? So I have a couple people working on clients. So is there questions that you have for us on web services, protocols, things we can answer?
Like, one of the questions I want to ask is, like, what are the use cases that people right now, like the marketing question, use web services, and where do you see it go? So maybe even the people here can tell us, like, what the product is doing, be interesting. And, like, from the exchange here, what is the, where are you aiming this feature to go? Like, what product's going to use that and things like that, so... To ask this question is because from our product implementation, which is one optimization, should we start to look to see if we need to optimize that traffic? Are going to be a lot of clients in the future? Things like that.
Well, Exchange, there's been a lot of investment in web services since 2007. Obviously, that's all brand new. So there's actually, a lot of the functionality that you can do through RPC ROPS, you can do now with Exchange Web Services. So looking forward, you know, it's obviously a place we're putting a lot of time and money into. If you're interested in comparing use case scenarios, an MS-OX Proto, there's actually comparisons of using the ROPS versus web services versus web dev, then how those different scenarios map to each other. So you might want to take a look at that and might provide you some extra information.
Yeah, the question was more for marketing.
Yeah.
Do you know a big application right now?
Let's say Outlook, how many users they have today? 4 billion? 20 billion? I don't know. So what's the biggest application for web services, and how many users does it have?
So since 2007, Outlook has used the web services for auto-discover, availability, out-of-office, and then just recently for 2010, mail tips. Also in 2007, unified messaging. So...
So I was going to mention that after Michael finished. Mac Outlook is actually using exclusively EWS to access data and return client information. That's going to be a premier client on the Mac platform, and they are using the web services to do all of that in the client. Robin?
There's sort of two classes of EWS applications. One is what we're saying, you know, full client-side implementations. Entourage is a good example of that. And as Michael said, Outlook's been moving more and more towards EWS. And then what we're seeing is a class of applications that we call line of business apps, where they're very targeted to solve, maybe a billing application that they want to use. They're going to query just the calendar functionality. And then some other industry segment might be more focused on contact management, and so they're going to build a specific line of business app to solve a workflow that integrates, maybe a CRM system into the exchange to tie the contacts together. So those are the types of apps that we're seeing. The big point to make is that in E14, we have really only two primary APIs left to do full flexibility or full interaction with exchange. You know, that's the Mappy world, and that's EWS. WebDAV is gone. All the old CDO stuff is gone. So we have transport APIs, and we have some other classes. But if you're looking for the two big ones, it's the Mappy Access, and it's the EWS. So,
We have other questions?
So the transport is SOAP, so the port, that means the TCP ports that's used to ATN 443, is that right? And in terms of connection behavior, can you give us an idea about how the connections are managed? Do you have the concept of a session across the multiple connections, or it's pretty much unaware at this point?
No, there is there isn't a concept of a session across connections. I'm not sure if does anyone else have an answer on that?
So there's nothing inherent with EWS protocol tied to sessions. Now, there's server-side benefit, performance benefits to going to the same CAS server. So if you're talking about high-scale operations, then making sure that subsequent requests go to the same CAS server will get increased benefit. But inherently, the client and server don't have a lot of shared session state. Correct.
Any more questions? All right.
There is one slide we put in the appendix that shows the evolution of the APIs that we've used, what's been deprecated, et cetera, that I think might be interesting based on some of the last questions that we received. So have we? That doesn't look very good on that screen, does it? So okay. So you can see draw your own conclusions on the directions that we're taking here. But web services is a big bet we're taking. Some of the other ones have been de-emphasized. There's no reason you can't implement these other protocols, but it's just the direction we're taking is towards the web services for sure. All right, if there's no other questions.
Yeah, thank you guys very much.
Thanks.